Feyre deceives Mor and forces Elaine to use her seer powers to locate the Suriel. Though the elusive creature appears forthcoming, supplying Feyre with much-needed clues to track down Hybern, the High Lady's good fortune runs short when she's discovered by Ianthe. Danger lurks throughout the forest as Feyre flees, uncertain if she will successfully thwart the High Priestess and save her dying friend. Once Feyre returns to the war camp, Nesta is summoned to scry to locate Hybern via the cauldron.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author. This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on characters and themes of this novel.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series spoilers may be discussed with or without warning. Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, death, and depression, will recur throughout the podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we are exploring Sarah J. Maas's most ambitious novel in the Court of Thorns and Roses series.
This is Jack.
And I'm Amy.
This week, we're discussing chapters 57 through 62 in A Court of Wings and Ruin. This week, we ask ourselves, in what way is this section telling us explicitly how this book will end?
The theme we see in this section is parallels. Let's start by recapping the current state of affairs. By the start of chapter 57, the Night and Summer Court armies have come head-to-head with Hybern again. While Rhys and co. thought they would catch Hybern by surprise, the fact is they've been fooled and are struggling to win the battle. Feyre has decided she must find the Suriel to change the tide of the war, but in order to do that, she has to shake off her eternal babysitter, the Morrigan.
The Morrigan. I missed that book from Babysitter's Club.
I never read Babysitter's Club. So.
Neither did I, so maybe there was a Morrigan one. My question is it realistic for Feyre to have left the battle at that time?
I really struggle with this. Yes, she's desperate, right? Her choosing to leave the battle shows the degree of her desperation.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody could have died.
Also, I don't know what she thought. We do know what she thought. She thought she was going to go to the Suriel and discover where Hybern's army is, but that doesn't solve the immediate problem that everyone's right. about to die.
Right. I mean, I guess if we think back on the conversation she just had with Rhys, probably the night before, there's nothing she can do about organized warfare. She has no way to contribute. So with that thought, she's like, oh, this is something I can contribute.
Yeah, but like
it just the timing is awful.
I would watch my friends die. I mean, like I support them to make sure they don't die. I take it back. I wouldn't watch you die. But like I would want to know if my mate and my friends are going to live or not.
I mean, think of Nesta standing vigil, watching Cassian the entire time.
Yeah. Later on, we're going to get into like Feyre not telling Mor and everything. But I think she should have told Nesta. I think Nesta would be like, dope, go.
Nesta would be like, whatever you got to do.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
Feyre is very, very cunning in her deceit, and I would say she's getting closer to Rhys's level in this regard. She expertly uses truth to lie to Mor. Quote, go join them. You're wasted here. They need you. It was true. Cassian and Az need you to push back the front lines. We saw last week that Mor was antsy not being able to participate in the first battle against Hybern, and Feyre not only marked that, but is now using it against Mor, appealing to her desire to fight by her friends, and in a lot of ways, appealing to Moore's pride as well. Though everything Feyre says is true, the High Lady's intent is not to win the battle, but to win the war, by finding and interrogating the Suriel.
The compliments. Oh my god, Mor, you are like so powerful. They really need you.
They can't do this without you.
You are so pretty. You should go.
Like, how is it not obvious?
Yeah, right? It's like, you're the most important person here. I mean, she was useful. Like, she's not lying.
Yeah, she was.
Note how Feyre is using those that Mor cares about most against her. Cassian and Azriel, not Rhys. And I think it's smart for Feyre to have done that. It's not just the tension between Mor and Rhys, but rather the fact that Rhys is way more powerful than everyone else.
I was about to say in my mind, but no, that's fact.
I think also Feyre is just more successful because to say go save Rhys is self-serving, whereas to go say save Cassian and Az really appeals more to Mor.
Yeah. I also think it shows like Mor doesn't have a soft spot for Rhys.
Yeah. She's like, he can take care of himself.
Yeah. Like that's her cousin. She's like, whatever. Yeah. Feyre is making a choice here, and I want to talk about that. Feyre chooses to lie to Mor rather than pull rank. Feyre could easily have said, I'm High Lady, I'm going to hunt down some information, and you're going to go and help them, them being the army. No questions, right? Like, Mor would have to listen because it would have been a command. I get why Feyre lied. One, she might not have thought commanding Mor would work. Second, she's learned from Rhys to lie and be sneaky. Like, he pulls this shit all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's believable that Feyre chooses to do it this way, but I also think it shows where she is in her High Lady journey, still struggling to give out orders and commands. I find this choice, Feyre not embracing the High Lady role, extra poignant when Mor changes for battle and then salutes to Feyre before winnowing away. Like, I mean, it's almost a reminder of could have done it a different way.
Yep. Yep. It's so true. You're so right. Because Feyre has begun to take on that High Lady persona, yet somehow she still holds back.
Yeah.
It's almost that she is treating Mor as a friend first rather than someone who serves her.
Yeah. Which is shitty because that means you'd rather lie to your friend
than command your soldier.
Yeah. I don't like that.
No.
I would have commanded you.
Yeah, you would have.
But with a please. And then extreme guilt afterwards. Please note, though, that Mor widows straight to Azriel. A fact that we're going to come around to later.
I want to point out that even Nesta tells Mor to help them, Cassian and Azriel. This, to me, demonstrates a faith in Mor that I didn't realize Nesta had. And that piece of information stings when you remember how shitty Mor is to Nesta later on.
Extra shitty, and we're going to see Amy reach her limit with Mor.
Finally. When Mor winnows into the fray, Feyre observes that Mor's, quote, damp golden hair was a ray of sunshine amid the mud and dark armor. Remember what we said last week about sunshine and battle? It foreshadows victory, and that is very, very clever of SJM. Feyre goes to Elaine for help tracking down the Suriel. Elaine, who is brokenhearted, who goes from campsite to campsite silently, never paying any attention except to step back into her tent. Elaine has been rejecting her Faenus and her Fae surroundings since she was rejected by Grayson. But instead of a broken woman, who's still crying, we find Elaine staring blankly at the ceiling of her tent. Last week, Jack, you said Elaine staring means something. Do you have a theory this time?
This is the one time I don't. I don't think she's having a vision. I'm curious as to what's going on in her head. Like, I don't know, maybe someone, one of our listeners could write something in and change my mind. But I really think what's happening is she is, God, I don't want to say sulking, but like she's processing a breakup. But there's a whole ass war happening right outside her tent. And that is a special level of, I don't want to be too harsh here, but I'm going to be, selfishness.
Yeah.
And I actually think this speaks volumes to Elaine's character right now and not in a good way. And I hope people see it for Elaine having more depth because I think people just think, oh, she's so bland, kind of a goody two shoes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, your fiance doesn't want you. That sucks. People are dying.
Yeah.
Your friends, the people who've been taking care of you are potentially, or they are at risk of dying. And she's just sitting there being like, well, Grayson.
Yeah, I love that you bring up this selfishness idea because we don't know to what level she's processing, but let's look at it this way. She viewed Grayson as the only person who ever really understood her and saw her. And that's a very selfish thing to want to hold on to, which honestly, don't blame her if she feels like she's not able to be herself around everyone else. So it makes sense that by losing that, she continues to be selfish because, but wait, this is the only thing I got to be selfish for.
Yeah.
And so she's just continuing that pattern. What I think is most telling of the situation is that Feyre is so desperate right now, she's willing to interrupt Elaine, where she hasn't been willing to like shake Elaine from how she's been processing up until now. And I think that says a lot for where Feyre's state of mind is at.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I'm now that I've like put the word selfish on her, it's really pissing me off that she's just wallowing while mm-hmm. people are dying. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I went through my breakup, yes, there was that. But I'm like, I had a lot of family issues going on for 3 months.
Yeah, you didn't process your breakup till much later.
Like a healthy person. Yeah.
It's so funny you say that because I was thinking that exact same fact right? while you were talking about Elaine.
Yeah, that's like what pops up where I feel like I can say it's selfishness. And again, someone's probably going to say, come in and be like, Jack, you suck. And yes, like I probably am coming in a really harsh point of view. And sure, I get it. Like, it's probably not the nicest point of view. But at the same time, it's like, you know, I do relate to it in a way. It wasn't war. But again, I feel like the war factor means more put your selfishness aside.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, you know what? I put my breakup aside and I was there for my family. And that's what needed to happen.
Right.
So, you know, you can process later.
Yeah. There are other times to dwell on stuff like that.
When Farrah asks Elaine to show her the cereal, Farrah notes that Elaine's eyes are glazed. And now I have more of a like, damn it, woman, pull your shit together. Your sister Nesta is freaking out watching Cassian. Mm-hmm. Go support someone else.
Yeah.
Wow. Look at that. Elaine evoked emotion.
Wow.
Wow.
There's a moment where Feyre thinks that she should have had Amarin train Elaine as well as Nesta, and I wonder if this is meant to imply one of two things, or both. One, Elaine is always neglected and looked over because she's perceived as fragile. Two, Feyre realizes that unlike Nesta, Elaine needs to be pushed and not necessarily coddled and regrets her past decision.
When you think about earlier in this book, when Elaine's mind was shut down like a fortress and she didn't even know what she was doing, it was just instinct. And now we can see her mind is a bit more open. The gates are a little bit open and she doesn't have that instinctive fortress lockdown going on.
Yeah, it's interesting how responsive she is. And it makes me wonder if we would have gotten more responsiveness from her earlier in the book if people had tried.
Well, I know they try to go into her mind because Rhys tried and Feyre tried and it was all locked down.
I forget that.
Yeah.
Scratch everything I just said.
Well, it just shows that, like, I don't know, her base instinct, her has better intuition than wallowing her.
Yeah. To what extent does this perceived openness, because the gates aren't open, but at least they're able to get into that part of her mind.
Yeah, they're open for her. That's a lot of control, too, actually.
Yeah, well,
now that I'm thinking about it, because she does just leave a little bit open for Feyre.
Right. It's interesting to me that they're able to get to that point since the breakup with Grayson. And to me, that implies, though she's wallowing, it's not the same sort of wallowing she had after she was made Fae.
Yeah.
Like, there has been some progress.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is going to be a parallel. What? To later on in this section when Feyre goes into Nesta's mind. So we'll compare and contrast for you guys later.
Yeah. I find Elaine's gates to her mind fascinating. When Feyre enters Elaine's mind to plant the image of the cereal, Feyre finds, quote, solid iron gates covered in vines of flowers, or it would have been. The blossoms were all sealed, sleeping buds tucked into tangles of leaves and thorns. This image may be what make people think that Elaine belongs in the Spring Court, but I want to argue that this is using the imagery of the Spring Court as a metaphor for High Fae and Prithian in general, since that was ours and Feyre's first introduction to the Fae lands. Elaine's gates are made of iron, a symbol of her human life attempting to reject the Fae, but they are covered in vines of flowers, just like the Spring Court manor was covered in vines of flowers as well. There are unbloomed flowers and thorns on the vines, which totally harkens to the Court of Thorns and Roses title, again, implying Prithian and Fae as a whole.
I love the point that you're making. It's definitely kind of a battle between her human side and then this other part of her. And again, it's almost like because there weren't roses in there, I feel like that is SJM saying, no, it's not Tamlin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's just a larger, like you said, a larger metaphor for Fae.
Exactly. The flowers, though, are sealed away as sleeping buds. And I think that this represents, again, not the Spring Court, but Elaine herself. And the fact that she hasn't accepted her Fae reality just yet and that she hasn't reached her full potential. And I'm excited to see if this imagery comes back in Elaine's point of view in the future and if we'll get to see those flowers bloom.
Mm-hmm.
Elaine describes the Suriel as moving, quote, through the world like the breath of the western wind. That's an odd throwaway detail. Until you remember that chapters later, after the Suriel has died and Helion has burned it, the last thing Feyre sees are its ashes stirred by a phantom wind. Significant?
Maybe.
Love that. Absolutely. I'm even thinking that the fact that Elaine says on the breath of the western wind, who is West? Highburn. Who is tracking the Suriel? Ianthe, who is working for Highburn. I also think this is foreshadowing of the fight that's about to go down.
I think that's a freaking great point.
Thank you.
Feyre winnows to the middle, the ancient forest where the Weaver of the Wood is and where the Suriel is lurking. We see Feyre struggle because she's depleted, and that weakness is important for us as readers to observe in Feyre and all of the other Inner Circle members as we get closer to the final battle, so that we feel like the stakes are high and that there's a chance the good guys lose.
It's so funny. They're so not. They so very much don't. And unlike every time before, the Suriel is there to meet Feyre instead of waiting to be caught. And they greet her with her human name, which is a reminder of Feyre's human heart as we get into this interaction.
I'm reminded very strongly of the power of three at the start of chapter 58, especially since Suri themselves calls out Feyre on this. This is the third book in the Thorns and Roses series, and the third time we've encountered the Suriel. There has been a very clear progression with these encounters as well. Let me recount them for you. In book one, Feyre catches the Suriel on bad advice with a chicken and a snare, and they beg to be freed when the Naga come, which Feyre does. In book two, Feyre catches the Suriel on better advice with a cloak and a snare, and they vanish when they want to because it's as if they wanted to get caught. And finally, in book three, the Suriel waits for Feyre to find them and approaches her. They attempt to sacrifice their life for her. And to me, that's freaking poetic. It's just this beautiful, tragic crescendo in this novel.
I love the journey of the Suriel, even if it makes me cry. The Suriel mentions both Elaine and Nesta. They call Elaine a trembling fawn, while Nesta is called a beautiful thief. As Amy mentioned, there's a lot of callback to previous books in this meeting. If we think of book one, Feyre was very much the frightened doe when she navigated the Fey world, like the trembling fawn. In book two, Feyre steals the book from the summer court, and the book calls her a thief, just like Nessa's being called a thief right now. I'm totally going to reach here, but let me reach. I believe the message the Suriel has for Feyre in each book also applies to both sisters in the books that I've kind of designated them here. The Suriel told Feyre to stay with the High Lord, nothing about mates in book one. Nothing to do about like, hey, High Lord's your mate, go stay with them. It's like, stay with the High Lord, right? As we know, Lucien will likely be a High Lord, which is again, like the message that I think the Suriel would be telling Elaine, stay with the High Lord. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with mates. It's about staying with the High Lord. And I kind of love this one because Lucien was the one who helped, or at least told Feyre how to catch the Suriel in book one. Mm-hmm. More of an extra connection there. Then with book two, Feyre discovers Rhys was her mate. I think that that message could easily be used for Nesta and Cassian. I'm sorry if there's no Silver Flames warning, but again, we can't help you anymore.
It's too close.
It's too close.
And if it's not obvious at this point.
Oh, yeah. Like that was the least surprise that happened.
Yeah.
To me, it just shows that all the sisters are interconnected and it's just some good callback moments here. Also, it's lines like these that make readers love the Suriel. When Feyre is shocked that she needs to die to stop the cauldron, the Suriel responds, ugh. I added that ugh, but I like to imagine that's there. Ugh. So dramatic, human heart. But yes, yes, the spell would have drained the life from you.
I could see you voicing the Suriel.
Ugh. Thank you.
You would just have the right amount of like flair for it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you die. Deal with it.
Feyre gets a lot of information out of the Suriel in this chapter, and I don't think it's necessary to go over all of it in detail because we know how it's all interwoven.
The one thing that I want to discuss is what the Suriel tells Feyre. Quote, only you can decide what breaks you, Cursebreaker. Only you. I feel like that is who Feyre is at her core. She's gone through all of this shit and decided what's broken her and what hasn't. And just because things break you sometimes doesn't mean that you can't put yourself back together, which is something that Feyre has had to do over and over again. It's a beautiful message, and I think we can all use it.
It is a beautiful message, and I am glad that you bring it up because it's key to her experience with the Ouroboros. I want to take a beat to appreciate the moment of impact. Sarah J. Maas does not use, quote, suddenly an arrow sliced through the Suriel's throat, or why did I use quote? I don't know. Next thing I knew, there was blood all over me. Honestly, that's tired and too aware for a first-person narrator. The narrative plays out the same way Feyre's confusion plays out. Let's really soak this in. Quote, it took me a heartbeat to register what happened, to identify the wooden thing that burst through the Suriel's throat as an ash arrow, to realize what sprayed in my face, landing on my tongue and tasting like soil, was black blood. And that gets a chef's kiss from me.
Absolutely. It makes the reader just as confused as Feyre is, and you end up going back reading it a few times of like, wait, what just happened? Did I miss something?
Yeah. Which is how Feyre would feel in that moment, because she's like having a conversation.
So rude.
Rudely interrupted.
So rude. And then she has to taste the blood.
Yeah, that's awful.
It's disgusting.
And this is when Ianthe reveals herself, asking why the Suriel talks to Feyre but would not talk to Ianthe herself. Let's think about this. Rhys searched for and couldn't find the Suriel in Mist and Fury. Ianthe gave the Suriel a cloak just like Feyre did, but the Suriel refuses to speak to Ianthe. It's as if the Suriel knows the type of people that are looking for them and the questions that those individuals will ask and determines whether or not those individuals are worthy.
Absolutely. If you could ask the Suriel one question, what would it be?
How do I find my literary agent? It's a good question.
It's a great question. Yep. Same. I'd be like, how do we get this podcast even bigger?
It would be self-serving for both of us. You can be like, how do we make this podcast bigger? And I would say, how do I find us literary agents?
This is the strategy that the Suriel would be impressed and annoyed with from
yeah,
us.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. He's like, you basically asked me 5 questions.
It's not my fault that you don't know how to structure your demands better.
Yeah. Chapter 59 plays out a lot like a chapter from earlier in this novel. Instead of Lucien tied up, Suri is dying. Instead of Dagdin and Branna, Ianthe is accompanied by 2 Hybern guards. Instead of bashing in her own hand, Ianthe is boasting about how the King of Hybern has protected her mind from Feyre. Just like in the Spring Court, Feyre debates whether she should winnow. She could get to safety if she just left now. And Suri Bey wants Feyre to run. But just like how Feyre couldn't leave Lucien behind to suffer, Feyre cannot leave the Suriel to die at Ianthe's hands. So, the High Lady does the equally noble or petty thing and chooses to destroy Ianthe.
Suri Bey, I love it.
Thanks.
It makes me, for next Christmas season, to rewrite, Suri baby, just a 54 convertible too.
I love it.
Light blue. But, like, all from Feyre's perspective.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah.
I appreciate this moment from Feyre. Quote, even after all this time, she, Ianthe, still underestimated me. Feyre has been very prideful in this book, and she's had to deal with her pride being shot down a lot. But this moment isn't a moment of pride from my point of view. It's a moment of awareness that Ianthe's own pride will now be a tool Feyre can use to take her revenge again.
Absolutely. Which the concept of pride and what we decide as prideful actions and not prideful actions goes into my next note.
Mm.
Because Feyre takes off running, and we'll get into how the special force helps her in a minute. But I just like the idea that running is normally seen as a weakness. Again, some people might be too prideful to run away and say, I'm going to fight you even if I don't have all the tools. Running away doesn't have to mean being a coward. It reminds me of book one when Feyre was running from the Midgard Worm and the spectators thought she was a coward and running away. Instead, Feyre uses her quick wit just like she's doing so now.
It's a great parallel.
Just so many parallels in this section.
Yeah. Yeah. When Feyre runs through the forest, she notes that she, quote, could have sworn that ancient forest moved to make room for me. Later down the page, Feyre will wonder if it's the Weaver's will that makes the trees move and open the path. In Mist and Fury, and also a little bit in Wings and Ruin, we've talked about the similarities between Feyre and the Weaver. What if the trees move for Feyre because she is like the Weaver? What if the forest views Feyre and the Weaver as the same? This is me just spinning some yarn, but it's an interesting thought.
I love that idea that they're the same. That they're, because we have compared them.
Yeah. Constantly.
Yeah. Also, we've always suspected there's something more because Rhys is kind of able to talk to the Weaver, just like his mother.
Mm-hmm. And Feyre is probably wearing her mating bond ring right now.
Good call.
That was in the Weaver's cottage forever.
Yeah.
Like, there's something going on.
Oh, yeah. And then the fact that Feyre runs for miles, just want to note that, because she has to run those same miles back.
I pity her.
And we would never survive.
Nope.
Nope.
Feyre also likens herself to a deer in this moment, which is a nice callback to Thorns and Roses and Feyre's humanity, because she's very aware of her mortality in the Weaver's presence.
Quick chat about the writing style. In this episode and in the last, SJM had some very short chapters, all depicting one scene. Each chapter was meant to get to a very specific point and a very specific emotion. This makes sense when everything is happening in the later parts of these books. This is when all the emotions are starting to happen. The briefness is what makes these chapters so impactful. Like, they're only like 2 pages long.
Yeah.
It's made writing these notes amazing.
Yeah. This is going to be a slightly shorter episode because of it.
And because we want to go hunt down the Lawn Pond Taylor Swift recording sessions on vinyl.
Yes, it is record store day, and we're going to go hunting. As Feyre steps over the threshold into the Weaver's cottage and into Chapter 60, Feyre holds the door open with all her might so that she does not get eaten alive. Because, you know, that's a turning point if she allows herself to get eaten. Turning point to the end. No? No funnies? No.
I didn't catch that.
Because she's on the threshold.
Oh. And there's a turning point? Like she physically
turned? No. I'm saying it would have been if she allowed herself fully over the threshold.
Oh, okay. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I didn't put it in my notes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
But it's significant that she steps over the threshold into the Weaver's cottage, but doesn't allow herself over it.
Yeah, no, it's totally, I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. Like, it is very much intentional, and then she just kind of hovers there to then ditch everyone.
Bye-bye. There's so much I love about this scene, but I think my favorite detail is this. The last thing the Weaver says to Feyre is, quote, "Who did you bring, little wolf? Who did you bring to me?" The whole time Feyre encountered the Weaver in Mist and Fury, she kept trying to convince herself that she was a wolf. Here and now, the Weaver, despite her blindness, acknowledges Feyre as a wolf. And that, my friends, is a very clear indication of just how far Feyre has come.
The Weaver also calls Feyre a thief, as if she's single-handedly trying to help me prove that there's a thief connection between Feyre and Nesta. Thank you, Weaver. And to continue with that, the Weaver asks Feyre what she is, a question we've seen Nesta get asked a fair amount in this book. And then finally, as Feyre is running, she compares herself to a deer, a callback to Elaine. Like, it's just, Amy and I were talking about this where I was saying, like, either SJM doesn't have enough animals in her knowledge of collection, a collection of knowledge, or this is significant.
I'm going to go with significant.
I'm going to go with significant, too. And also, just because I know everyone loves a good food is power moment, as do I. When Feyre tells the Weaver that Ianthe and the guards are dinner, it's just a badass moment.
Yeah, it is. When Feyre returns to the Suriel and offers to heal it, the Suriel refuses and insists it's already gone. What I noticed during my note-taking session for this episode astounded me, and I'm shocked that I didn't realize it before. The Suriel's death has parallels to Rhys's death later in Wings and Ruin. The parallel is made stronger by the Suriel talking about Rhys before they die and Feyre's realization that the Suriel had come to help her because, quote, it was a dreamer, just like Rhys and her friends. When the Suriel dies and their heart stops beating, quote, its sudden silence echoed into my own. This is the same silence Cassian talked about earlier in Wings and Ruin. The silence one hears when someone they love is gone. Feyre experiences it here with the Suriel. She'll experience it again with Cassian in a few chapters, and she'll experience it most when Rhys dies. Feyre also weeps on the Suriel's chest. Quote, I laid my head on its chest, on that now silent vault of bone, and wept. Exactly the same way she will weep on Rhys's chest when he dies. SJM is doing us dirty with all this foreshadowing.
Aggressively so. And I love it because even with all this foreshadowing, SJM is also making direct parallels in Feyre's mind to Rhys with the Suriel. When she's trying to figure out how to help the Suriel, Feyre says, I do it the same way I helped Rhys. And, you know, like she's making those connections of how she found Rhys and mm-hmm. what's going on there. And it's just, it's sad. I cried. I cried mm-hmm. especially when Helion showed up and Feyre made him give his crimson cloak to the Suriel.
Yeah.
That was really sad. Even as I was writing my notes, single tear dropped down.
Oh.
Yeah.
Helion returns Feyre to the war camp at the start of chapter 61. And it's sweet how Rhys just knows and takes Feyre into his arms so she can cry. But the visual of her crying against his chest makes me think of his impending death again.
Again.
Especially when she begins to weep, quote, at the smell and warmth and solidity of him. Since that's exactly the opposite of what Feyre finds after she puts the cauldron back together later on. And I see what you're doing, SJM. You're laying it on so thick.
You don't know it's being laid on thick.
We don't.
It's just a lot of butter being smeared onto toast, and we don't see the butter.
We don't see how our arteries are being clogged.
But that's also why it tastes so good, is because of all the butter.
Yeah.
I really want toast now. Rhys washes Feyre's hands, and to me this represents Feyre's own guilt for what happened. She believes it's her fault that the Suriel died, and she still has their blood on her hands. She understands it wasn't her fault, and it'll be Rhys, the one who's washing her hands, who helps her understand that.
Mm-hmm. Feyre re-experiences the quiet that Cassian described earlier in the novel, and maybe it's most appropriate she connects the dots herself now, since it's Cassian himself who's wounded and near death. So I'm going to say this now, and I'm going to have to bleep it out.
Yep.
Mor's a f***.
Yeah.
She's more concerned about reaming into Feyre than Cassian right now. And look, I get it. Mor scared Feyre went off and got herself killed, and that Mor is to blame. But that does not give Mor the right to be a bitch to anyone, including Nesta, in a few pages. And that especially makes me extremely mad.
It's like a couple episodes ago where I was saying, and this is the moment she's dead to me.
Yeah, Mor's dead to me at this point.
Yeah, it's the, on my deathbed, I will look up and be like, damn it, Mor. Mor's reaction is so over the top, not SJM being over the top, Mor. And I think there's a reason to that. I think Mor believes Cassian is hurt because of her. And I think she's right. Mm. When Feyre looks to Asriel, she notices that he only has a few cuts, while Cassian had his guts hanging out. Remember when I pointed out that Mor went straight to Asriel when she entered the battle? I think that's a clear evidence that Mor's priority was on Asriel, not Cassian, leaving Cassian vulnerable. Mor is lashing out at Feyre, and it seems excessive. I really believe she's blaming herself, especially when you think about the last battle, how it was Cassian who got hurt, although it was just a sprained wrist. But when Mor found Nesta taking care of him, she kind of, not freaked out, but she was like, oh my God, what's wrong?
Right. And she does it twice.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that Cassian's the one that's hurt each time. In the first battle, granted, it was just a sprained wrist, but his was the injury that was pointed out.
Right.
And then now his is the injury that's significant.
Yeah, I think there's obviously reasons for that, right? Cassian pushes himself too hard. That's his character.
Mm-hmm.
And let's also think about it from the perspective of SJM writing this novel. If Asriel was the one who got hurt both times, Mor would have to face their relationship.
Yeah.
In a way that there's no room in this novel for that.
It also makes Nesta and Cassian have to face their relationship, which is what we want to do.
Right.
But it's also, in my mind, thinking poor Cassian
has
to get beat up twice.
He's a pincushion.
Yeah.
Let's take a moment to focus on Rhys, though. Rhys is exhausted, and though they won the battle, it was not an easy win. Feyre observes, quote, panic in his eyes, not the controlling fear Tamlin had once succumbed to, but genuine terror of not knowing where I was, if I needed help.
Rhys asking Feyre to leave a note when she leaves and how he doesn't want to control her, but it's just like, hey, you know, leave a note. Totally, absolutely valid. Now, if only Rhys can do the exact same freaking thing, it's please.
It's so funny you say this because I underlined that, like, leave a note. And I was like, oh, now you're asking for information?
Right?
King of giving no information?
Yeah. Like, what about the time when you left your marital bed to go to the Autumn Court?
To wipe some brains.
Wipe some brains. Yeah. What the hell?
Rhys panics again when Cassian comes to. Quote, you and your damned theatrics on the battlefield nearly got you killed. And even as Rhys spat the words, that was panic again in his eyes, his voice. These moments are so important to note as we get closer to the final battle. Rhys is terrified, and his terror is going to influence his decisions and exacerbate his need to sacrifice himself. And Cassian responds with a little bit too much on the nose remark when he says, quote, so you're allowed to be mad about our choices to protect you, and we're not allowed to be furious with you for your self-sacrificing bullshit?
It's allowed. Like, yeah. Strategically speaking, Cassian is not wrong. Rhys is the leader. He is the High Lord. He has to stay alive. Cassian should sacrifice himself for Rhys. Everyone should sacrifice themselves for Rhys, minus Feyre, obviously. But again, like, you're not going to get the president of the United States throwing themselves in front of people, in front of the CIA. Like, you have a vacuum of power. Like, that's what would happen.
Right, right. If Rhys goes, Feyre's not ready to take on the leadership role.
Fall to her.
It would fall to her. And that's a perfect opportunity for Kyr to come in and, you know, the Court of Nightmares to take over. You can't afford that vacuum of power. And Cassian knows that.
Yeah. And it's on the nose, but it's also, I don't know. I just wish it was like someone would just kind of say, like, point it out, like, you're not my friend in this situation. Mm-hmm. You're my High Lord, and we have to protect you at all costs.
Right. And didn't they swear to Feyre the same, you know, like, yeah, with our lives?
Yeah.
And then Mor and Feyre get into a fight. And honestly, I'm so mad at Mor, and I don't really care to talk about her. This is what I will say. The only thing I will say. Nope, I say more about Mor later. Damn it. About this moment, then. Mor was duped by Feyre. Mor's power is truth. Mor is mad that Feyre lied. So either we are right that Mor has to activate her truth powers and is therefore mad at Feyre because Feyre broke a level of trust because Mor doesn't think she has to use her powers on Feyre. Or there's an alternative. Mor's powers aren't real or no longer exist. We talk about a listener theory that was sent in to us on this topic in a mini episode that may or may not have aired by this point. But basically, the thought is, what if Mor used to have truth powers, but for whatever reason, because of her trauma, they no longer exist and she's just like continuing a ruse?
Other variations of that is, well, she's not truthful to herself, then her truth power doesn't really work to the full amount.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of this is plausible.
Oh, absolutely. Mor's treatment of Nesta is bullshit. She barks at Nesta, telling her to refill the bucket. And Nesta, surprisingly, has enough grace just to look at Mor and walk away. Something that Nesta's done multiple times.
Yeah.
When Mor's lashed out, she'll just look at Mor and then walk away.
Secretly, yeah. I think Nesta knows that Mor's beneath her.
I think it's pretty aggressively loud. It definitely is a...
You're not worth my time.
You. Okay. Absolutely. Feyre, on the other hand, says, nah. In the heat of this fight, Feyre defends Nesta, saying, Nesta is many things, but she is certainly loyal. And I just kind of feel like that's such a dig to Mor in the sense that, like, we're sisters, you're not.
Yeah, you aren't my sister.
Yeah, snitches get stitches. Nesta's my ride or die. Fuck you. Mor goes for blood, telling Feyre she thought Feyre was better than to trick her, implying that she's supposed to be better than Rhys. But Feyre hits back at Mor, telling her, shut up, you're not honest to yourself at all. which it's kind of a stretch on Farrah's part. Like, clearly that's something that she's been boiling up inside of her, but it's so not.
Honestly, it's something I would do. I would totally bring up something tangentially related, but not really related to the situation.
And I'm just like, what the fuck? Like, this comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
We're talking about this situation.
But it makes sense that they're airing their grievances at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Amryn shows up at the end of chapter 61. And as we enter into chapter 62, Amryn coaches Feyre after her fight with Mor. We all remember our first introduction to Amryn in Mist and Fury included the tidbit that Amryn and Mor got into a fight that burned down Rhys's favorite mountain retreat. So I would say Amryn knows a thing or two about fighting with Mor. It is significant, then, that Amryn says, quote, "Be careful of how you push her. There are some truths that even Morrigan has not faced herself." Now, for those of us who've read the book, we're thinking more sexuality, but I want to suggest something else. I want to suggest that there are other deeper truths about Mor and her identity, maybe even something multiverse related, that we aren't privy to yet, that Mor has not faced within her, but that Amryn is aware of. And I think Mor's sexuality is actually a red herring in this situation.
I love that so much. I think you're right. I think there's going to be something completely separate. Like, people definitely have been teasing out, like, Mor's truth. You and I were talking about this, and I asked you, Amy, because you're bi, and I don't want to ever diminish anyone coming out and the strength that that must take. I don't know. I haven't been through that. But it's so hard to be like, but all of your friends aggressively love you.
Yeah. And, you know, when we were talking about this, you were like, but isn't this the sexuality piece? And you were expressing your confusion. And I was like, well, yeah, well, think about it. Mor has had partners, continues to have partners, was in love. Yeah, she doesn't want to tell her friends because she's worried, but she hasn't hidden that part of herself from herself.
Yeah.
She's faced her sexuality.
Yeah, it's not a denial of herself. It's a denial of telling her friends because, like you said, she knows.
Right.
She thoroughly knows. And you're telling me that she doesn't suspect them knowing?
Right. Seriously.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot more sense that her sexuality is the red herring. I freaking love that.
Continuing on with the scene, Feyre claims that Amryn might be able to smell the fight on her, just like Amryn smelled the mating bond between Rhys and Feyre early in Mist and Fury. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if Amryn smells Mor's sexuality or all of Mor's secrets anyway.
Smells Mor's sexuality? What does it smell like? Does that mean you smell like her?
I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, God. I don't even want to know what straight smells like. I think it's like mothballs. That's
maybe.
I smell like mothballs. Amryn 100% knows, whether it's through smelling purposes or otherwise, Mor's sexuality. And like we were saying, it's the biggest secret that never was.
Yep. At this point, Nesta joins the rest of the inner circle in the tent after Amryn's arrival to scry.
I want to point out that this entire episode, Nesta does not say much. In recent episodes and recent chapters, Nesta doesn't really talk. And she's really the one who's sitting around observing everyone. It just speaks a lot to her character and the fact that she's absorbing everything. It only makes Silver Flames all the more tragic, but also makes all the more sense, too.
Mm-hmm.
Cassian is supporting Nesta, making himself get up, even though he's injured, and be by her side during her time to scribe. Feyre is surprised at the physical contact. That's Cassian putting his hand on Nesta's lower back. And Cassian's just a rock for Nesta, and he tells her nothing can harm you because he's there. Because
he's a big, burly man who will protect her.
Although it's really hard because, like, I know what he looks like. I know what people draw him, but it's really hard not to imagine, you know, in the cartoon Mulan?
Uh-huh.
Like, the three guys. There's, like, the really skinny guy, the big guy, and then there's that short guy with the voice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's hard for me not to imagine Cassian like that.
Yeah, yeah. Same, but taller.
Yeah, well, no, I just kind of always felt like Cassian gave me Short King vibes.
Aww.
Even though I know he's 6'7".
He's the shortest of the three.
No, I think he's the tallest.
I always imagine Azrael as the tallest.
I know, I think Cassian is, like, the biggest and tallest.
Oh.
He's 6'7". He's not Short King. But
he's got Short King energy.
But I mean it in a good way. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
like,
it does.
Short King energy is just like a confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's
of
true.
So Cassian's our Short King.
As Nesta goes to grab the bones and stones Amryn brought with her, Feyre notices that, quote, arcs of mud lay beneath Nesta's nails.
This detail is so important, and let me tell you why. Nesta, in Chapter 2 of Thorns and Roses, picked at her nails and refused to chop wood, implying not wanting to get her hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Look at her now. She stood in the rain and kept vigil over Cassian during the battle. She collected water for wounded soldiers while trudging through mud. This is a beautiful, beautiful, like...
character growth and arc.
Yeah.
And it just makes me scream at her for Silver Flames.
Yeah.
It's so freaking tragic. And I just feel like, you know, when people don't like Silver Flames, your opinions, respect it. But just like have it with this context of how much Nesta has grown from Thorns and Roses to Wings and Ruin. And she's willing to let it all go up in flames because of her trauma and self-hatred.
Yep. Yeah. It's tragic.
Absolutely.
I want to look at the bones and stones really fast. Amryn explains that the three stones are the faces of the mother and doesn't know the purpose of the bones. I see a direct parallel to the Courts of Prithian. The stones are described as, quote, white as the moon, which makes me think of the three solar courts. The bones, there's four of them, make me think of the seasonal courts. And I try to think about, like, seasons and bones decay. They don't really decay, but they, like...
Well, they're seasons of life.
Good point.
Yeah, like people, you know, the people talk about your seasons of life. Yep. There's childhood, adolescence, baby, adolescence, adult, and all that stuff. It's funny because I literally had the exact same notes, which is always one of those moments where you're like, oh, okay, I have nothing to add. But to me, it just means that this felt very purposeful because you and I both found it.
Yep. And it makes me wonder if it's going to come back somehow.
I think so.
It takes reassurance from Cassian for Nesta to be willing to scry, and it gives me the chills. This part in particular stands out to me. Quote, I, Feyre, marveled at the touch from Cassian that she, Nesta, allowed, marveled at it as much as I did the mud-splattered hand she held out, the concentration that settled over her face. As we spoke about before, this moment represents a very different Nesta compared to the start of the series. This is a Nesta in the process of accepting her Feyness and her Fey life, and it's so tragic that she makes so much progress only to regress by the end of the novel.
Mm. One day when we cover Silver Flames, I don't think we'll ever stress just how tragic that step back is.
Yeah. Nesta makes a terrifying trip to the camp of Hybern and her mind, and Feyre has to go into her mind to save her. Unlike Elaine, Nesta's mental gates, quote, belonged to an ancient fortress, sharp and brutal. Now, I know that Nesta can be sharp and brutal, but is Nesta an ancient fortress? How much of this image reflects Nesta's actual mind, and how much of it is altered because of the powers she stole from the cauldron? I wonder if somehow we'll see this fortress again in the future, because to me, this fortress looks like something the cauldron would be housed in, not something... that is inherently Nesta.
I mean, I feel like we know that she would be rock solid.
Right.
Of some kind. So, like, I think fortress makes sense, but at the same time,
but
I
ancient?
Agree that it would look a little different. Feyre goes into both sisters' minds in a very short amount of time, but Elaine only needed to find the cereal. So, Feyre kind of, you know, left a lovely image for her there, while Nesta is out there hunting for Hybern and ends up getting stuck in there. What it's showing is that Nesta has opened up to Feyre to a degree, because Feyre only had like a little room for Elaine.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Nesta, it was wide open. Granted, you can say that's wide open because she's scrying and she's looking for the cauldron, but it shows that the connection's different, especially the fact that once Feyre gets to Nesta, the sisters run out hand in hand. It's a level of familial support that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, I love this image because to me it reminds me of when the ravens find Feyre and Nesta in the library and Feyre grabs Nesta and's like, run!
Yeah, like Feyre's been there for Nesta both times, grabbing her hand and running to
save
her.
Yeah, it's she doesn't just abandon her sister or say like, I hope you can keep up. She literally drags her with her.
That's sisterly love, dragging someone's ass.
Yeah, which, I mean, in some ways, Feyre does to Nesta in Silver Flames.
I don't understand, like, the concept of running with someone's hand, though. Like, I always think that would slow me down.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. But yeah.
I know the initial dragging, but then it's like, you know, we ran hand in hand. I think I'd be like, I'm good.
Yeah,
let go. Let go. I can barely run as is. Okay, I can't have your hand stopping me.
Yeah, it's true. We end the chapter with everyone freaking out about Highburn and Varian swooping in to kiss Amarin, which may be among the best moments of this entire novel.
Even Amarin looks surprised.
I love it.
Yeah. All right, let's get into some breadcrumbs. I'm trying to think, are there any multiverse spoilers in here?
No.
Okay. You guys lucked out. So in chapter 58, when Farah and the Surreal discuss nullifying the cauldron, Farah says, "It was killing me." The Surreal, "Did you think you could leash its power without a cost?" Farah, "I need to die to stop it." The Surreal, "So dramatic, human heart. But yes, yes, that spell would have drained your life from you. Just like it'll drain the life from Rhys later." Surreal was basically warning Farah aggressively and loudly, and she didn't listen.
Farah.
She never did with the Surreal.
No.
They died as they lived. Ignored.
In chapter 60, Helion finds Feyre in the forest by the Weaver's cottage, and she thinks, quote, "I didn't care how Helion had found me, why he'd found me." Just a nice little clue for the big Striga reveal later.
Mm-hmm. In chapter 62, Feyre and Rhys are thinking about how they're going to win the battle, and they list it in this order, how Jiri and Tamlin, Miriam and Draken and the Carver, how each of them won't be able to help in the ultimate battle, and they're just so screwed. And then, like, every single one that they listed will help them.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Because that's how SJM works.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I love a good save the day moment, yeah. But it's just really funny when it's listed out just like that. And it's like, oh, well, you know, every single one of them will come in and save you guys.
Yep. Yep. Also in chapter 62, when Feyre is trying to think of the options against Highburn, quote, "There was the Carver. If I dared risk retrieving his prize, I didn't mention it, didn't offer it. Not until I could know for certain once I wasn't about to faint from exhaustion." So I bring this up, even though Jack just mentioned it, because SJM has to keep reminding us of the Carver and the Ouroboros as an option so that when Feyre is out of options, we believe her trip to claim the Ouroboros.
And we also believe she's willing to leave a middle of a battle to go do something else.
Right, exactly.
Which is kind of funny now that I'm thinking it. Like, that's a whole other parallel of like, okay, shit's going down. Bye.
Yeah, yeah. Rhys, you remember how you left our marital bed? I'm leaving ours now to go get the Ouroboros.
Yep, yep. So, can I ask you a question? In what ways is this section telling us explicitly how this book will end?
So you used a great metaphor earlier. SJM is laying on a thick layer of butter on the toast of this story with so much foreshadowing. But as first-time readers, we completely have no clue what we're getting into.
Mm-mm.
She is laying it out perfectly what is going to happen. Rhys is going to die. People are going to come save them.
Almost action by action.
Yeah.
Like, even the action of a High Lord being there for Feyre after Rhys dies.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because then they all come in and save him.
Mm-hmm.
She lays her head on his chest. Like, mm-hmm. It is almost scene for scene how Rhys dies.
Yep. Yep. And it's fascinating that I haven't caught it in the rereads until now.
So until we, I mean, isn't that what happens? Is we don't even really know what we're doing until we write it down and talk to each other.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. But it's fascinating. And I really admire the precision and the thoughtfulness of all of it.
Yeah, I do too.
It makes it feel like it's not an accident or coincidence. Like, this was very intentional.
I agree. Especially where I didn't talk about this because I didn't think there was enough to it, but I'll bring it in now. I always kind of found it curious, this whole Ianthe comes out late, like kind of pops up just to die, and it's almost like a tiny little loose end being wrapped up,
mm-hmm.
which maybe it is. And I don't know how this might be referenced or paralleled to something later in the book with Rhys's death, but like it all is so intentional and purposeful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's a parallel to what Feyre had to deal with in the Spring Court, right?
Yeah, but I think all of this is foreshadowing for later. Rather than just past. But again, you're right. Like, this whole, that whole entire thing was a lot of like, here's what happened in past books. Here's what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. It was just everything. It was all of it.
And I love it. I love all the callbacks. I think SJM did it expertly.
Absolutely. This is probably some of her best foreshadowing.
Yeah.
And I'm even thinking back to season one when Feyre has a dream of a shadow figure and it's Rhys.
Mm-hmm.
This to me is more aggressively better foreshadowing just because we don't know what's happening.
Yeah, it's so subtle.
Yeah, like you have a dream of a shadowy figure. Yeah, you're going to clock that.
Right, right, right. Exactly, exactly. Whereas this, you don't even know that, like, oh, this is play by play
exactly what's going to happen again later on.
Yeah, you're just thinking, oh, this is sad. Yeah. No, it's going to be sad, even more sad later.
You know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of in Deathly Hallows when Hedwig dies, you cry.
Oh.
And you don't even realize that it also, like, foreshadows Dobby dying.
Yeah, it just everything.
Oh, so painful.
Everything. Oh, my goodness. The, whatchamacaller, the HBO series coming out with that, with Lin Yu. It's almost like we might potentially have to cover that.
What?
What? Talk about the disclaimer on that one, though. It'd be we do not support J.K. Rowling in the fucking slightest. And now, let's read some of our reviews.
This comes from Katie from Australia, titled My Fave. I am obsessed. I did a trip through Europe listening to this podcast, and now every time I listen, I remember my trip. I never really cared for technique analysis, but these girls changed my mind. I love listening in. Everything they say changes my whole view of the story, and I can't wait to go back and reread the whole series with their points in mind. Also, their accents crack me up every time. As an Aussie listener, hearing them talk makes me have a little giggle in my car on the way to work.
Why?
I mean, as long as we're amusing, that's what matters.
Yeah, that's what matters. I know we have thick American accents.
It's so funny how biased Americans are that we're like, we don't have accents. What are you talking about?
I was talking about this with my roommate and we were talking about the Valley accent and how back in the day people used to make fun of the Valley accent. But through media and movies and TV and everything,
it is not the American accent.
It's the base level.
Yeah.
Right. So at least there's that. I don't know where I was going with it, but it's like, at least we've conquered America. Next up, the world. No, I love literally anyone else's accent.
I also love that Katie said every time she listens, it reminds her of her trip, because I totally understand that. Every time I listen to One Republic's Apologize album, I think of my family's trip to Yosemite.
Yep. There's some songs I can't remember off the top of my head, but like our Europe trip, like I think like there's like a couple Downton Abbey episodes that we'd watch Downton Abbey afterwards. And like I think of that.
Yep. It's And so I love that
we're that for someone.
We're that for somebody.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy.
We're an associated memory. We've made it.
We have made it.
I love this. Thank you. If you want to be featured in one of our weekly reviews, please go to Apple Podcasts and write in a 5-star review. Pretty please. Thank you. Love you. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Next week, we'll be exploring chapters 63 through 65 of A Court of Wings and Ruin.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a weekly mini episode.
If you are enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo. You can also follow us on TikTok or Instagram at the handle Book Talk for Book Talk.
Bye.